go. The John Curley, Sherry Ellicker Show, and you along for the ride. Much appreciated. Sherry, you don't have time to dive into the news because we are joined by the 2011 Teacher of the Year when it came to science. Vanessa Ramsey joins us on the line because I saw this piece that Todd Myers has in the Washington or National Review. Washington State's new climate curriculum attacks rational thinking. I'm reading through the article, and I see this Todd's showing all the new sort of ways they're going to try to teach science. And then he goes all the way down here, and all of a sudden, hey, here's the Teacher of the Year. Vanessa, thanks for coming on. Todd talks about you in this article. I guess he called you and wanted to know your reaction. What were some of the things that sort of stuck out? This is approved by the state of Washington, and this is a curriculum that can be taught in schools, and this is about primarily the science of climate. Were there any things in particular that you came across when you saw what was coming down that was to be taught in class that shocked you the most?
Yeah, hi, thanks, John. There were several things that really stood out to me. One of the things I know Todd already mentioned was just absolutely condemning rational thinking. There's also a pretty blatant science anti-science attitude that came across in this curriculum. And I think the thing that bothered me the most was really a manipulative way of guiding students towards political activism, specifically within the realm of environmental justice is the term they use. And they really do that by implanting, you know, ideas into students' thought process through the use of these emotional narratives.
So I remember in science class, you have a hypothesis, the scientist has a hypothesis, and then you test it with an objective eye, and you keep running the numbers through to gather the data to prove or disprove your hypothesis, and then you say, oh, eureka, and then you jump out of the bathtub and you run naked through the streets, right? I just remember that from sixth grade science.
Of course.
There is no emotion involved, but this, they say that it should be emotions first, because it's how you feel about something before, and then the data is either used to support your emotions. That's the complete opposite of the basic sort of tenets of how science is supposed to do what science does.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was pretty duplicitous in the way that, you know, instead of just giving students their primary data source in this curriculum was this Washington Tracking Network. And so instead of having students just look at the data with an open mind, they really pull on students' heartstrings with some social narratives that they have woven throughout the various modules, which is just, you know, leading students to these predetermined conclusions within these parameters of social or environmental justice. Like some of the key questions that they ask, you know, I think key questions are absolutely essential. It's a good teaching practice, having key questions or learning targets. But what they've done with their key questions, they're not guiding questions about science, about the data. They're around social issues, emotions, or taking social action. So some of the things they're asking students, you know, about are like, how do you feel about this narrative? Or name some of the emotions that you can imagine. Or what comes up for you as you think about X, Y, or Z? So it's very emotion-based.
Huh. Is there a place for emotion, Vanessa, in science? Should this be eliminated, or is it just displaced, that the science should come first and then your own personal feelings around it should come later? Or should we not even enter into that? We should just use the data and just use that as our conclusion.
Yeah, that's a great question, Sherry. Science it needs to be an objective method about learning about our physical world. And I really think we need to remember that and just keep applying that objectivity and teaching that to our students. So I would say, like, during scientific research, we need to remain impartial. We need to set aside emotion and just examine the data. Then we can take, you know, the data and the conclusions and then go ahead and bring that into the realm of social issues. That's where we can apply, you know, the science and move forward. Because, of course, we want to learn about the world around us and learn how we can, you know, best improve our lives and, you know, our environment. But within scientific research, no. I think they've really, you know, mingled that together, and it needs to be kept separate.
Todd states in this, is one sentence from the Washington State new high school curriculum is,
For far too long, science and science education has prioritized my rational thinking.
Mm-hmm. When I first saw that, I had to pick my jaw up off the floor. If we don't have rational thinking in science, what are we left with? I noticed something at the end of the curriculum. It was repeated several times in the final module. They repeated several times, science is not enough. Science is not enough. I'm thinking, well, what else do we need here? And they're implying we need to bring emotion into this.
And you know, it's the history repeating itself, right? First, it's a tragedy. Then it's absurd, right? Then it's a comedy. You go back to the medieval years, right? You take the scientists that would say something against the church that we go around the sun. Oh, okay, we're going to put you in house arrest, Galileo. Or irrational numbers and square roots. We're going to tie a rock around your neck and throw you in the ocean so you drown because you're saying things that just go beyond what people feel about something. I mean, this is very, very similar to that thinking, that emotion, or you can use faith, right, or religion, it trumps the basic reality, the 2 + 2 = 4. We all agree with that. And then once we get the data, then we can act upon the data. But why do you think they're doing this?
Oh, boy. That's really hard to say, John.
Would you say that's hold on.
Yeah.
Vanessa, would you say that's a better question than what Sherry just asked? Just
oh, okay.
Just for the record.
He's very competitive.
Just for the record.
Talk about emotion.
Go ahead, Vanessa. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No worries. No, that's fine. It seems very plain, having gone through the entire curriculum. I spent months combing through it. But they are guiding students. I mean, that's the ultimate end in the final module. They want students to be these political activists within the realm of, they call it, this environmental justice or climate justice. Mm-hmm. They have activities that they want students to do to get involved with certain social groups and certain activist groups. That seems to be the final goal of this whole curriculum.
And Vanessa...
Go ahead, Sherry.
Oh, I was just going to ask her, because I know, because you won Science Teacher of the Year in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How have things changed? What are your observations? I mean, not just this, but just in terms of teaching science, the interest in science, what kids are leaning toward. What are your observations about that?
I think what's changed, and that's kind of two different layers. I think what has changed, what I've observed just at the administrative level, is less focus on just going through the scientific inquiry process. What students, they're so eager to learn. They love science. Typically, I've gotten back into teaching again recently, and they are so excited to learn science. And so there's a lot more, definitely, since 2011 with coding and robotics and engineering. So I think giving students more opportunities to actually go through the scientific inquiry without bias, definitely giving them different opportunities to explore a variety of science concepts, and that's the way to go. And they want that. But it seems like there's less emphasis on that, at least what I've seen at the administrative level and in public education.
It seems to me from reading the article from the National Review that Todd Myers wrote that this is a curriculum that you can use. You don't have to. Mm-hmm. This is just one that the Washington State has come up with. And here you go. Here's a curriculum you can teach. So if you don't want to use it, you don't have to. So say, oh, I know, but we don't use that one.
Yeah.
So they can use other ones. It gives them, a fig leaf to cover on this. But still, it's the fact that the state, our money, pays these people to come up with this curriculum.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, that's why I've always felt, and I used to Dury Monson say all the time, that climate change for people has become a religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it seems like.
Yeah, yeah, I don't disagree with that. Yeah, I believe, the climate is changing, but there's... a lot of question about what's the cause of that. And I think we need to look at that objectively and without an implicit bias.
Yeah. All right. Well, you're teaching again. Where are you employed? Are you allowed to say?
I'm in the state of Montana now.
By choice, you left Washington not for any political reason, but just you like big sky country?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yes to all that. Okay, for all that. All right. Well,
do you find the political climate there different in the schools? Not quite as progressive, or what do you see when you're teaching there versus when you taught here?
That's a loaded term, progressive. I am enjoying teaching once again. I will say that much. And small school, and it's lovely.
All right, we'll leave it at that. All right, Vanessa Ramsey, Teacher of the Year 2011, now in Montana, enjoying everything that state has that this state doesn't at this point. All right, we'll leave it. All right, thanks, Vanessa. Appreciate your time.
Yes,
continue the good work. All right, there we go. All right, I was going to brag and do my body in motion tends to stay at motion. Body at rest, Sherry, tends to?
Stay at rest.
There we go. That's the law of Jacob. Jacob, that is the law of...
He's on the phone with Vanessa right now.
Oh, okay. All right. Andrew, he will pass to you. That's the law of... body motion tends to stay at rest. Body rest tends to stay.
Wait, I didn't understand that. Are we talking about Newton's laws of physics?
Inertia. Inertia was the answer we're looking for.
Oh, it's such a great question. I ask myself that every day.
Yeah. You know what? Hold on a second. Jacob, let me ask you something.
I swear to you, I did not prepare the guest.
Oh, my God. When we get these guests on, if you say, when Sherry asks a question, if you could just say, that's a great question, that would be
really... That was unprompted. Yeah. Absolutely not prompted. I submitted my questions, and I don't think that was actually one of them. So, no, she had no prompting at all.
And I have done that before, to be clear. We have had a guest. I've told a guest to do that. That was not one of them. That was, sincere.
Oh, okay. All right. Hold on. So you have told guests ahead of time, prior to coming on the air. It would be great when Sherry asks a question. No, hold on, Sherry. You have done that before. You've set the guest up to kind of backhand me by saying, oh, that's a great question, Sherry.
No, I can tell you what he's done. When somebody has done that and said it's a great question and then you got upset about it, the next guest that comes on, if it was like in the next segment, he said, now say it's really great, just to rub it in.
I think it was Matt Markovich, too, is actually a reporter, and then he did it like every question she asked and became really obvious really quickly. So... You know when I'm prompting.
Yeah, play games. You're playing games. The two of you are playing games. All right. Well, you know what? The next person comes on and does that. It's going to be like, well, that doesn't count. We're just going to have to doubt it, right? Because the science, that's the data. How many guests come on, percentage of guests that come on, percentage of guests that are not prompted by Jacob to say, oh, that was a great question, Sherry. But she said the exact same thing. Oh, Sherry, that's a great question.
Is it possible it's true?
How do you measure greatness compared to what I'm asking?
Well, she didn't say you had a great question, so I'd say you're measuring it up against... She just randomly said my question was great.
Oh, some Teacher of the Year.
Okay.
Wow, now all of a sudden...
yeah, I know. She was a great guest.
Questioning all of her qualifications.
You're being difficult because she didn't say it to you.
All right. Well, the question afterwards was not as good, by the way. So I just thought.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you're keeping score. Thank you for measuring everything. It's much appreciated.
I can't help it. I keep emotion out of it. It's just data. Uh-huh. I'm data driven. I got a hypothesis.
To keep everybody happy, Jacob, from now on, please tell the guest to say John's first question is a great question, no matter what.
You want me to stack the deck in the opposite direction?
There you go. Put your thumb on that scale.
If you have to.
Do you know what? I'm just going to say, whoever has the better question, just tell them at that. Well, no, maybe, I don't know. I just feel like there's
How about this? How about that's not a good question? Why doesn't anybody ever say that?
Well, because I think they're polite, but you could put a compilation, a montage of all the times people have told me I had a great
question. That's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, is that what we're going to do now?
I just think the last question for every guest, it should be which one of you had the better question.
Better questions.
All right, that's how we're going to start
each one of these
interviews. We get them on, We'll get them on. We'll set that up, and then we'll dig into what we're talking about.
They have to end the interview by making an enemy of one of you.
Yeah, right. And making them feel incredibly awkward.
Tomorrow.
Book somebody, anybody for the next segment. I don't care who it is. Get somebody on. Right, here we go. There we are. Tactical problems behind us here at the John Curley Sherry Elliker Show. And you right along for the ride. Much appreciated. You're with us. Writing to us at mynorthwest.com or texting as well. 1-888-973-5476. State Roofing text line. You're a Vegas kind of gal, Sherry?
I am not. No, I am not a big gambler, and I don't really like Vegas
careful,
that much.
Careful.
Huh? I've been there several times, and it just, I don't know, something about it. Doesn't appeal to me.
Is it the smell of Febreze and cigarettes?
It is. There is that smell. Yeah, that kind of is a turnoff. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just not that into gambling. Are you? Mm. Are you a gambler? I bet you
no,
are.
No, hate it.
Really?
Hate it. Can't stand it. No. Just don't get any pleasure out of it. I went to a casino once and played blackjack. I think it's blackjack. Give the guy the $20. He sticks it in the little hole. I see him push the money down. They were in cash back then. And I watched it go in, and then I busted on the hand, and I was just like, well, that wasn't any fun. The average person loses $500 on a single visit to Las Vegas. They're there for 3 to 4 days, $150 where they're budgeting, but they lose it at the casinos. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal saying that the casinos in Las Vegas have decided they want to make more money. So they're changing the odds on a bunch of different things. And I got about 10 paragraphs in, and the math became too complex for me. But they basically explained that your chances of winning at a blackjack table, was it one? I forget what the odds were, right? So if you bet $15 and $10, you win like $5 or something. They're now making it harder for you to make more money. They're also upping what it costs to get into each one of the tables rather than having a $20 table. So they're changing the number of tables, reducing the number of tables, higher stakes to get in to play to get more money. They're also raising the room rates, food rates, everything else. Just, I guess, maybe they want to attract a different clientele.
Yeah, they say they want to get a higher value customer in Vegas. And this is the math, if anybody can follow it. So blackjack historically paid out a ratio of 3 to 2 when a player hit 21 on the first two cards. That means a gambler wins $15 for every $10 bet. Now blackjack tables pay 6 to 5, which means the same $10 yields only $12. I'm sorry, the same $10 yields only $12. So,
right. So $2 is the win or $5 is the win.
Yes.
Cash in your pocket. You threw 10 out, you won 15, you get $5 back. Okay. So they're changing those odds. Yep.
And, you know, they want to be able to, I guess, make it a little bit harder that everything is in the, you know, toward the house, right? So you know that. And this is the thing is, how is that going to attract more people? If you know that Vegas is betting against you and the odds are less, even if you're a high roller, that kind of changes the whole fun of it, right? I mean, if you know it's going to be tougher to win and the odds are against you anyway, and now they're really against you, how does that attract more people?
Well, let's assume that when they say they want to get a better clientele, if they get really swamped because people are traveling there, you'd rather have somebody with more money at the table than somebody with not as much. So we have a bunch of people that don't have a lot of money that are jamming up the seats, jamming up the tables, and they're making small bets on these things. And, you know, they're winning and losing. But if you want a higher class of clientele, people with more money, you just make everything more expensive. You make the win less desirable. And then you make the cost of everything more expensive. You'll get different people in there, right? The difference between the people that go to McDonald's on a Friday night and the people that go to some fancy French restaurant where it's a fixed price for, you know, $185 per person, you get different clientele. So maybe that's what Vegas is going for. They'd rather have less people spending more money than more people not spending as much money.
They also say the labor costs make the table games more expensive to operate. Do you remember, John, in Atlantic City, how basically you could get a free hotel room? I mean, it was like they would give away, you know, if you booked a hotel room, they would give you like a bunch of credits, a bunch of things. I mean, it was you could almost stay for free. I mean, it was a real, this was, you know, 20 years ago, but I can mm-hmm. remember going there and thinking, wow, this is amazing. They are really desperate to get people in here.
My brother and I got a summer job working there in 1980. We had to join the union, and then we worked at one of the casinos. And this casino, when it first opened, it's just been open for a little while. Men had to wear a jacket,
mm-hmm.
which was the most ridiculous thing because they were on the boardwalk. Nobody's out there walking with a blazer on, right? But they wanted sort of decorum. They wanted to look nice. So they had a whole rack of jackets, like blazers, for the men. Big, big racks of they were gross. It was gold colored, like a Century 21 rep or something like that. And my brother and I were working busboy. Then we would do other stuff where they wanted to put us. And then one of the things he used to do was you would be now in charge of giving out the jackets, putting men in these blazers. Well, the guys that worked there were so mean. Big fat guy would show up there. Oh, you look like a 41 short. They'd put him in a really small one, or they'd put a giant one on a small person. It was, and the guy would have the weird back hair. He's got the tank top on. Right? Comes in, he's covered in sunscreen and sweat. And then you, excuse me, sir, let me just place this over you. There we are. And you just get your arms in there and you bring the rat pack around. And there you are, sir, you're all set. Guy's like busting out from behind on the thing. It just looked ridiculous. I think they got rid of it after like a year and a half because they, you know, nobody wanted to come in and have to put on.
Gross jacket with somebody else's sweat and sunscreen and who knows what else in there.
The people play the slots. Slots is the best game for the house. It's the worst chances for you to win. But people will play the slots a lot. That's why they have so many of those things. And then the blackjack table. And I think Vegas, you're right, when used to be also down in Las Vegas, you know, you had the big buffet, pay like $20 or $15, stay at Circus and get yourself a bed bug or some other, maybe a ringworm, pick that up for free. And enjoy yourself in Vegas, everybody.
Yeah.
Never been my cup of tea. Always feel
maybe it won't
really
be that depressing now.
It's,
I know. I mean, it is. Don't you think it's depressing? You go in there and these poor people are at the slot machine. They've been there for hours and hours. They got their bucket of coins and they're just sitting there and sitting and just and then just the bad behavior, the drunk behavior. The whole thing makes me nervous.
I used to go there every year for this Consumer Electronics Show. It was like 5 days. It's the biggest convention they have
in
Vegas. CES. Yeah, CES. I was there as a spokesperson. And, man, after 2 or 3 days, you just feel gross.
I know.
Just all grossed out.
It's like no sunlight or something. I don't know what. I don't know if it's night or day.
It's hotel air.
Oh.
Didn't you also say, John, that was always the same weekend as some type of porn convention?
The Porny Awards.
Okay.
Yeah, well,
that feels like it might contribute to the sensation that you're having.
Do you think the Porny Awards were not like, oh, hey, when is the Consumer Electronics Show when all the super nerds are there? Let's make sure we have the two of them overlapped. Yeah, they knew what they were doing, those porny people.
That had to make it a little more interesting.
For best threesome. God. So weird. Okay. No, like this. The person has the fake personal assistant. Jacob, I'm gonna have you become Sherry's fake personal assistant.
That would just be me being a real personal assistant. That's not a fake.
Yeah, this woman was had a real. She created this. She was her fake personal assistant.
Oh, so there was no person. She didn't even have her brother faked. Her brother faked it a couple times for her, right?
No. I don't think so. I think
we'll teach you, how to have fake status. We'll come right back. I'll tell you something. Some of the most powerful words that you can send to somebody or say to somebody is, please contact my assistant. It really makes you feel like you've gone somewhere when you have an assistant, right, Sherry? Like, assistant's taking care of all the stuff that you're just too busy to take care of. And if you have an assistant, you've kind of moved it up from somebody else that just doesn't have the assistant.
Yeah, you've kind of arrived. You know, the fact that you're important enough that you have to delegate some of your duties to somebody else because you're just too important to have to do them yourself.
Yeah. So there's this woman who 10 years ago set up a fake personal assistant. She said it started out by accident, has made people take her more seriously. Is there sound on this thing, Jacob?
Yes.
Oh, when you press one of those buttons in there, would you, with your long, weird fingernail?
It's in there, but I will play it for you,
no,
I suppose.
See it.
Okay,
I don't see
good.
It.
Personal assistant is me, although I go by Matt in emails. I get an entirely different reception from individuals when I negotiate speaking fees or consulting contracts when it is through the persona of Matt than I would as Jamira. People treat you entirely different when they think you have an assistant, and also when that assistant is a male. So yeah, I would say it has worked out wonders for me. I also feel much more confident asking for particular pricing or accommodations when I do so from a voice of a man.
Ooh, wow. How about that?
So she is using a guy that she knew in high school who she admired named Matt. And she said he was this guy who just kind of breezed through everything and was never totally surprised when he got advantages and got, you know, was successful. So she used him, his name, because she emulated him. But she goes on to say that, you know, she feels like that there is, she said, this is what I've learned. We all have to move through the world with the certainty and confidence of a white man. Mm-hmm. We are just deserving. And until we can ask for what we need ourselves, have someone like Matt ask for you.
Uh-huh.
So she's saying that with her name, people would know she's a woman and know that she's probably not from this country. And therefore, it would have put her at a disadvantage, whereas Matt clearly sounds more like a white male name. He garnered more respect and took her where, because he was acting as her assistant, she was able to be taken more seriously.
Huh. Wow. That's interesting. I wonder if you talk to a 50-year-old white male, if you feel that he's at a greater advantage, especially in today's hiring rarefied air of DEI. Do you think he would be chosen over someone else when the corporations are making big, big moves to hire people of diversity?
Highly unlikely.
Since she trades now.
Yeah, I also think that this is sort of defies what it is that she's trying to accomplish here. If you really want to break barriers, don't put the white assistant in front of you. Go do it yourself. And
right.
I mean, you know, it's how is it ever going to move ahead? If that's your objective is to get to the point where you feel like everybody is treated equally, then you have to make the first step and take that risk and be out there just as you are. Don't put Matt, the white assistant, in front of you.
Does she say that in her emails? I'm sorry. I'll have Matt, my white assistant, get back to you.
She thinks that it is probably apparent or that people assume that he's a white guy because Matt's kind of a white guy name.
Okay. Got it. All right.
And it's based on a white guy that she knew in high school.
No, that's right. Well, listen, if you want to be a real powerhouse, then you say, hey, you can have my, and then you have your assistant have an assistant. That's even better. So you have them send to one assistant, one made-up assistant, and then that person goes, you know what? I'll have, you know, Jerry take care of this. He's my assistant. And then there's all these layers, and people feel, oh, this is going to be really great because obviously it's just in a one-man band. This is a person that has a whole bunch of employees.
Yeah, and I wonder if she took on, like, a different tone as Matt. Like, did she speak like, you know, like a dude? I mean, what did she do to make sure that people didn't catch on?
I don't know, but let's write her and see if we end up getting a chance to talk to Matt.